I'd like to call this meeting to order. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. Today's date is February 28th, 2012. Time is 9 o'clock in the morning, and we have a full committee with us today. We have Senator Geisel, Senator Meyer, Senator Kukesh, Senator Pasvan, myself, Wilikowski. Today we have two resolutions before us. Following that, we'll conduct hearings on four nominees for the Alaska State Commission on Human Rights. The first resolution is SJR 15, which urges the United States Congress to fund all the facilities and vessels necessary for the United States Coast Guard to fulfill its Arctic missions, including icebreakers and an Arctic Coast Guard base. Second resolution is SJR 17, which welcomes to Alaska the Arctic Council Task Force for Arctic Marine Oil Pollution Preparedness and Response. It's my hope, and if the committee, if it's the will of the committee, that we move these resolutions from committee today. Before we begin, I just want to introduce Thomas Presley, known as TJ, a University of Alaska political science student and intern in my office. He's carrying several bills for me, and today he'll be taking a turn as our committee aide. Thank you, TJ. Let's begin with Senate Joint Resolution 15, sponsored by Senator Olson. We have a CS before us. Could I have a motion to adopt / CS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 15 / B for discussion purposes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion purposes, and welcome to David Scott from Senator Olson's office. And if you could walk us, just tell us what the resolution does and tell us the changes that were made in the CS. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. Senator Olson's at Senate Finance, couldn't make it today. The resolution is, it really does two things. It's five pages long. It's the longest resolution I've seen in 7 years. There's a whole pile of whereases and two be it hereby resolves. But the two resolves clauses ask the United States government to fulfill its Coast Guard mission in the Arctic and forward base the Coast Guard in the Arctic. The second thing it does is ask the United States government to fund icebreakers and other ice-capable vessels. The impetus for this resolution, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is the Northern Waters Task Force, where we're formalizing one of the recommendations of the Northern Waters Task Force, and we hope to get this through both bodies so that when members visit the nation's capital during energy break, we have them in hand. There's more. There's a whole pile of information I could we could discuss and ponder with regarding maritime operations in the Arctic and recent situation in Nome and bringing the Rend and the Healy, that whole operation also we're gonna have some offshore development in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, and hopefully it goes from exploration, and keep our fingers crossed, we'll get some production from that. There's a big future. The Arctic and maritime industry is going to play a big future in the state of Alaska, and we're asking the federal government to also step up to the plate as well. That's basically the crux of it. The changes, Mr. Chairman, are four of them. They're very brief. On page 4, line 28, at the end, during in who we send the resolution to, we made some changes for protocol issues. The second change is on page 1, line 6, in the first whereas, or the second whereas clause, we deleted on equal footing. That was in there because the equal footing clause of the Constitution. We removed that. It's kind of redundant, I guess, if you read the other whereas clauses below it. Page 2, line 4, after tourism, we added other activities, kind of a catch-all. Page 4, lines 25 and 27, we did change one of the resolve clauses, and instead of, we just changed the language to not be so prescriptive, I guess, to be a little bit more gentle in our suggestions. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I can ask, I can answer questions about the mechanics of the resolution. There's also, we have Mr. Ed Page, who's a retired Coast Guard member, and he is the executive director of the Alaska Maritime Exchange.
Great, thank you. I think it's a much-needed resolution. This is an important issue. I think a lot of times people in the lower 48 forget we're an Arctic nation. Are there questions for the committee sponsor? For the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, we'll go right to public testimony, and we have Ed Page in the room. Mr. Page, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman.
Put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. My name is Captain Ed Page. I'm U.S. Coast Guard retired, and I serve as the executive director for the Marine Exchange of Alaska, which is a nonprofit organization down the street here that's been established in 2001 and is supported by the state legislature and the Coast Guard and the maritime industry as a vessel tracking system. My comments are really based on my Coast Guard experience of 30 years and also in the marine industry, which is the last 10 years. And I want to preface my comments by saying I really appreciate the longstanding support the state of Alaska and the legislature and the governor all have provided the Coast Guard over the years during my Coast Guard career and afterwards. It's always great to see a state so supportive and so fond of the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard brought me to Alaska first in 1973. I was sailing on the East Coast and got tired of the North Atlantic and decided to go to the calmer waters of Alaska, silly me. And I first came to Juneau in 73, and I had several assignments over my 30-year Coast Guard career in Ketchikan and Juneau and up in the Anchorage area in western Alaska. But the dynamics have changed over the years. When I first got here, the Arctic really wasn't much of a discussion. The Coast Guard would go up there on occasion to do research efforts. Toward my latter part of my career, I was the Chief of Marine Safety and Environmental Protection for the Coast Guard operations in Alaska. And even then, the Arctic, nothing much was happening up there, and our focus elsewhere. But just in the last 10 years, things have changed. And we've had ability through the vessel tracking system that the state has supported, as well as the Coast Guard and Maritime Ministry, which utilizes automatic identification system, which is required to be carried by vessels and broadcast, much like an aircraft, every couple seconds information on the vessel. So we can now see what's happening in Alaska, up in the Arctic. And we're now seeing activity we never saw beforehand. And we've seen cruise ships. We've seen tankers now sailing from Russia, taking the Northern Sea Route to go to the Far East as a way of a more efficient and shorter route. We've seen many cargo vessels going up to the Red Dog to take zinc to other parts of the world. We're seeing, of course, domestic trade of tugs and barges going up the Arctic and offshore supply vessels and oil exploration vessels and research vessels. And so suddenly there's a fair amount of activity up there. And even we see on occasion, which is somewhat disconcerting, is even a Chinese icebreakers nosing around our waters and exploring what resource we have, etc. So there's clearly the dynamics have changed, and the Arctic is now open to shipping, and the Coast Guard's presence has historically always been a factor ensuring compelling compliance with the various environmental safety laws, providing a search and rescue capability and oversight role, and facilitating trade by breaking ice and opening the seaways. And this is not a novel concept, obviously. The Great Lakes have been doing this since 1944 when they realized the importance of their industrial complex in the Great Lakes and to fight the war, or win the war, if you will. And an icebreaker was provided and served for 60 years. The Coast Guard Cutter Mackinac served for 60 years in the Great Lakes. And if they followed their lead, when they built that ship, they made sure it was too large to ever get out of the Great Lakes. It was larger than the lock, so it's still there. It'll never leave because it's so wide. So if we can buy it, ensure a breaker that shows up in Alaska, can't fit the Unimac Pass, we'll have it for good. The vessel was replaced here recently, about 5 years ago, with another cutter named the Mackinac, and it's somewhat of the equivalent of a maritime Swiss Army knife, I would say, because it does aids in navigation, it does buoys, it does search and rescue, it does law enforcement, it has environmental response capability, can recover oil, and it breaks ice, and it facilitates trade. So this has been done elsewhere around the country, even in the New York area. The Hudson River has been opened by icebreakers to allow oil barges come down and provide the oil needed for New York in the wintertime, what have you. So it's not a novel concept. It's certainly, it's our time is right to have increased Coast Guard presence in Alaska. It's great to see the state of Alaska throwing their support to the Coast Guard, which they have historically always done. And I think that the presence of the Coast Guard, both through a breaker capability to operate up there, as well as having some forward operating base so they can conduct their operations, certainly the best interest, not just of Alaska, of our nation. As we all know, the resource up there affect our whole nation. So I'm very pleased to see the support. I'm fully behind it, the maritime industry behind it, and I make myself available any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Fassifan.
Sure. You know, you mentioned the Russians and the Chinese and their activities there. Is there an indication that their increased attention towards shipping in the Arctic is connected with the loss of the Arctic ice cap?
I would say the fact that they can operate there and conduct, oil exploration, production, or minerals, or what have you, that's changed the dynamics as far as what's available. Beforehand, it was basically inaccessible. Now it's becoming more accessible. Ability to bring those commodities out of the Arctic through vessels, again, makes it more attractive. So I think those dynamics and, of course, the greater demand for resource all are leading to increased interest, and that's why they're there.
Yes, Senator.
Just kind of a follow-up question. You know, I keep hearing all these different boundaries. You know, we have 12 miles and 6 miles and 300 miles. Kind of define, if you could, what those boundaries mean when it comes to shipping lanes in the Arctic.
Through the chair, if I can. Yes, sir. Well, there's the lines, and there's obviously territorial seas, contiguous zone, and there's exclusive economic zone, and we can exercise different authorities at different regions. But we can even go beyond the EEZ if we can show the continental shelf goes beyond there. And that's some of the discussion of the United Nations Law of the Sea adoption of that. But clearly the Coast Guard, or the United States through the Coast Guard, can exercise considerable authority in shipping activity, even out to 200 miles out, as the weather impacts us. And even beyond that, intervention of High Seas Act exists. So if they're beyond 200 miles, it can be argued and shown that it has some impacts on our waters. You can even extend that beyond. So there's a tremendous amount of authority the Coast Guard can exercise if the U.S. stakes their claim and exercise our sovereignty and through a presence. If we have no presence, we can't do any of that. So I think it's key to have a presence.
And just as one, you know, for you, if, you know, I've never been in a ship in the Arctic seas or Arctic Ocean, when one looks from like Barrow and you go 200 miles north, how much further is it from there to the North Pole? So we have an idea of, well, what the waters might be up there.
It's still several hundred more miles, and I haven't sailed up on the Arctic Sea, so I believe there's some other people available to testify, perhaps, to talk of that. But it's still several hundred miles, but the ice is changing. Clearly, it's becoming more broken, more accessible, and people are taking advantage of that. There's even yachts are showing up across the top and cruise ships. So people recognize that it's a different world, for us and we're an Arctic nation. Most people, as Mr. Chairman, as you pointed out, that we are an Arctic nation, and everybody recognizes that, but we're certainly painfully aware of it. And it impacts our whole nation by exercising, and taking advantage of being an Arctic nation.
Yes, just sir. As more comment, I believe last year was the first year that both the eastern and western shipping routes were simultaneously open, the first time ever in the history of, I guess, our knowledge of history. So that's just kind of my understanding of what is occurring.
It's pretty fascinating. You think about it, if I may add, Mr. Chairman, is that there really are only two access points to the Arctic, and one of them is in our backyard. It's kind of like going to be the I-5 for going to the Arctic, right through our backyard. And people looking at the Coast Guard is doing studying that as far as the waterways assessment and how we exercise safety and environmental protection measures in the Bering Strait, but it's building. We can see that activity increasing every year, so it is happening.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Page, could you talk about the collaboration between the U.S. Coast Guard and the Canadian Coast Guard in terms of search and rescue and emergency response in the Arctic?
Well, through the chair again, I know there's considerable discussion, and just signed an agreement, international SAR agreement for the Arctic, and I know there's a periodic conduct of both oil pollution exercises and search and rescue exercises with our Canadian counterparts on both borders, or in respect to Canada, I mean Alaska anyway, two borders on our side anyhow. And but of course there's, as you folks are definitely aware of, the resources to exercise search and rescue that the Coast Guard has available to them is Kodiak is really the closest capability. So that's hours away, and you know, it's basically almost 1,000 miles in many cases to an event that may happen up there. And that's one of the Coast Guard's concerns, is having the ability to leave an aircraft up there and out of cover, out of the weather and the elements, so if they have to mobilize, they can't do so. That would be the long-term picture. But and the Canadians have a much greater actually presence in the Arctic. Of course, their Arctic area is larger than ours anyhow, as do the Russians. And I know the Coast Guard actually interacts very closely with the Russians and meet periodically with them too. So all our Arctic neighbors, they are interacting with and have these agreements, but our capabilities to really carry out what we hope to do is somewhat strained by the tyranny of distance in Alaska and where their bases are.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Just to follow up on that, if I may, Captain, thank you. Do you have a recommendation on where the new Arctic base should be? I mean, I think we all think Nome or somewhere in that area, but I don't have a clue.
To the chair again, I really don't. I've heard many different opinions and thoughts, and I really haven't delved into what would make sense. And also, when we talk about a base, we're talking about two different bases to some extent, in my mind anyway. It's a base to facilitate the aircraft, which could be up in the Arctic, and then the other one would be facilitate vessels, which is a bigger challenge because of draft and the ability to come close to shore. And to some extent, an icebreaker capability does provide a platform where they can operate up. So it's a floating base of sorts that they can carry a helicopter on board and crew and operations center. Basically, all those capabilities can be provided by an icebreaker. But there's still a considerable amount of talk and discussion and debate, but I haven't followed closely enough, so I'm afraid I can't opine too much on that one.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Captain, thank you very much for coming in. Appreciate your testimony. Okay, we have one other person online, and that's Jeffrey Garrett. Mr. Garrett, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, if you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members. Thank you very much. I'm Rear Admiral Jeffrey Garrett, U.S. Coast Guard retired. And I'm, as a Coast Guard officer, I spent much of my career serving in the nation's multi-mission polar icebreaker fleet, including time in Alaska. And for most of that time, the polar operations were limited to defense support and science programs sponsored by other agencies. But the transformational changes that Captain Page has talked about occurring in the Arctic now really affect all of the Coast Guard's statutory responsibilities. And so I've watched the Coast Guard in the past few years make a valiant effort to project an Arctic presence by deploying cutters, boats, aircraft, and specialized teams to the Arctic in the summer to test equipment capabilities and procedures and enhance Arctic operational experience. But as the committee is well aware, the most critical and effective capability the Coast Guard could apply to its increasing Arctic responsibilities is largely missing from the scene. And at a time of growing need, our polar icebreaker capabilities are steadily drifting into obsolescence. The consequences of long-term disinvestment in our icebreaker fleet are beginning to emerge. The Coast Guard has been unable to deploy an icebreaker for Arctic multi-mission purposes for over 2 years, and planned science missions for the Coast Guard cutter Polar Sea have had to be canceled. The nation has had no icebreaker available to provide critical annual resupply of the U.S. bases in the Antarctica this year, forcing reliance on an expensive short-term charter of a Russian vessel. Then, in addition, the need to ensure that the city of Nome received fuel supplies last month were accomplished by the icebreaker Healy, and I was privileged to have been part of that effort. But while successful, it was accomplished only at the cost of extending Healy's lengthy Arctic deployment and disrupting planned maintenance and operations later on this year. So I think Alaskans clearly understand what's happening in the Arctic today, and I'm happy to see the needs for adequate Arctic resources cogently summarized in this joint resolution, as well as a resolution strong call for the federal government to provide the U.S. Coast Guard with the capabilities, particularly polar icebreakers, to meet our national needs in the Arctic. The fact that the President's 2013 budget contains some initial funding to begin an icebreaker acquisition is an encouraging sign, this important action must move forward quickly, and we must restore the Polar Star and Polar Sea to full operational capability in the interim. There is really no substitute for having the right tools to meet the challenges of a transforming Arctic. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Admiral, thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions? Are there any questions? I see none. Thank you again, Admiral Garrett. Anyone else online? Okay, hearing none. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. We did hear that there was the hope was that we could pass this so that members could bring this to Energy Council that are going next week. I do think it's an important resolution. We need to spread this word. What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move the CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 15 version / B from this committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations, and I believe zero fiscal note.
Yes. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the resolution is moved from committee. Congratulations, and we'll pass around the recommendation sheet. While we're doing that, let's move on now to Senate Joint Resolution number 17, which would welcome the Arctic Council Task Force for Arctic Marine Oil Pollution Preparedness and Response to the state for its March 2012 meeting. We have Cheyenne Ely, an intern in the office of Senator McGuire, who will present the resolution. Welcome to the committee, Cheyenne, and put yourself on the record. Give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Cheyenne Ely. I'm an intern for Senator McGuire, and she is in she is in Senate Finance Committee, so she asked me to present Senate Joint Resolution 17. The purpose of SJR 17 is to welcome the Arctic Council Task Force on Oil Spill Preparedness and Response, and they will be in Alaska in March of this year, and to express Alaska's interest in protecting our environment. The Ottawa Declaration of 1996 formally established the Arctic Council as an organization for promoting cooperation, coordination, and interaction among the Arctic states with the involvement of the Arctic indigenous communities and other Arctic inhabitants on common Arctic issues, in particular the issue of sustainable development and environmental protection in the Arctic. The Arctic Council consists of 8 Arctic nations: Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the United States, as well as 6 international organizations representing Arctic indigenous peoples. The Arctic Council signed the Nuuk Declaration on May 12, 2011, which established an agreement on cooperation in aeronautical and maritime search and rescue in the Arctic. The Nuuk Declaration and the ministers of the Arctic Council established a task force to develop an international instrument on oil pollution preparedness and support. The Arctic Council's task force is developing an instrument which would allow vessels transiting the Bering Strait and Aleutian regions that should have a safe passage, as well as oil spill response for marine oil spills. Ships in the Bering Strait and Aleutian regions will engage local authorities in oil spill response preparedness. It is important to have a cooperation among the Arctic nations to develop an international instrument on oil pollution preparedness and response, as well as recognizing the importance of conducting joint training exercises and exchanging information and experience. Where most resolutions are sent unsolicited to an audience, SJR 17 is an attempt to try a new tactic. Since the Arctic Council Task Force for Arctic Marine Oil Pollution Preparedness and Response will be in Anchorage on March 20th, prompt passage of SJR 17 will give the state of Alaska an important opportunity to put its concerns front and center before the task force members at the welcoming ceremony. Senator McGuire thanks the committee for its consideration and their active engagement in this resolution and other Arctic issues. As the world looks to the north, Alaska must assume a leadership role, and SJR 17 is one piece of that broader active Arctic engagement strategy. Thank you for the consideration, and I am Michael Pulaski, and I'm available to answer questions.
All right, thank you, Cheyenne. How many members are coming? Do we know, roughly?
This is a big... Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, this is Michael Pulaski, aide to Senator McGuire. There will be a representative from each of the nations that are a member, formal member of the task force, and then there will be naturally all the support staff that comes along with it, but it's the leaders of all of the groups. The senator's office didn't know until 2 weeks ago that this meeting was actually confirmed, that it would be happening in Anchorage, so there was a little bit of time lag between introducing the resolution, deciding to do anything on it.
Okay, questions? Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we're working off version M, I'm assuming?
Yes.
M as in Mary, okay. You mentioned the Arctic countries that were going to be participating. Are there any Arctic countries not participating? And if so, does that cause any potential problems?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, no, it doesn't. The Arctic Council, this is a specific task force under the Arctic Council, and those are the Arctic nations that are participating in it. So it's a formal group that's been empowered internationally to take a look at these issues. And it includes all eight of the Arctic nations, as Ms. Eli said at the beginning of her presentation.
Great, thanks.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Passman.
Yeah, one of the attachments on the Arctic Council, they talk about products and a response instrument, and I was just kind of wondering what is it that they mean?
Senator Passman, through the chair, if you go to the Arctic Marine, the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment Project, this is kind of an example of the beginning of what a response instrument would be. That's an all-encompassing strategy for response, and naturally when you're going internationally, you have to deal with multiple different groups. As Captain Page was saying before, the technology transfer between regions is significant. I think for the committee's awareness, page 16 of the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment talks about the current vessel traffic in the Aleutians. There's a lot of attention paid to the Arctic, but right now over 2,000 vessels are transiting the Aleutians in Innocent Passage every year. When Senator Meyer was chair of DEC subcommittee, we had one of the largest oil spills in Alaska history with the Selendang IU. The instrument is a technical term at the international level under the International Maritime Organization that governs those things. And in the resolution on page 2, you'll see the talk about engaging local authorities in contingency planning on page 2, line 20, having adequate oil spill contingency plan response capacity, page 2, lines 15 through 16. The issue is, under international maritime law, the state of Alaska doesn't have jurisdiction over vessels in Innocent Passage. So getting this group to push at the international level a voluntary framework of engagement is really the ultimate goal of the resolution. And since the group will be in Anchorage, it's a cornered audience that the legislature can again express its leadership on Arctic issues.
Other questions? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone in the room wanting to testify? Don't see anyone. Anyone online? Don't see any. Let's close public testimony. Any final words, Cheyenne or Mr. Pulaski? Okay, I don't see any.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a question. Thank you for the presentation. This is definitely caught my interest here. When do we know the date on this other than March?
March 20th.
March 20th? Okay. Is that a weekend or? I don't think it is. I think 24th is a Saturday, so it must be in the middle of the week. Okay, thank you. We'll figure that out.
Okay. Are we getting somebody online or no? Next week. Okay, great. If there's no discussion, will of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move the Senate Joint Resolution Number 17, version /M, from this committee to next committee referral with individual recommendations. I don't believe there's any fiscal note on this one.
I believe there's an attached zero fiscal note, or there should be. Yes.
With attached zero fiscal note.
I think their requirement is that all, even resolutions, have fiscal notes. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the resolution is moved. Okay, let's move on now. Let's take a brief at ease while we pass around the sheets, and we're going to move on to confirmation hearings. We're going to go off the record very briefly. Okay, let's go back on the record. We'll now move on to confirmation hearings for the governor's nominees to the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. The commission was created in 1963. It was created to eliminate and prevent discrimination in employment, credit and financing practices, places of public accommodation, practices by the state or its public political subdivisions, and in the sale, lease, or rental of real property. Under state law, it is illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, religion, color, national origin, age, sex, physical or mental disability, marital status, changes in marital status, pregnancy, parenthood, or practices of the state or its political subdivisions. In 2010, over 2,000 Alaskans contacted the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. Interestingly, 20% more Alaskans filed complaints of discrimination in 2010 than the prior year. We'll hear from four nominees: Krista Bruce, Mark Fish, Joanne Holmes, and Joyce Scaffelstead. We will hear from Krista Bruce first. This past August, Krista was appointed to serve as a commissioner for the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. Krista should be online. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee. If you could put yourself on the record, give us a brief description of your qualifications to serve on the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights and why you are interested in this commission. Thank you.
Yes, good morning, Chairman and committee members. It's good to have this opportunity to say hello. I am assuming that you may have my resume. At least I've been vetted, but I am lucky to have been born in the United States of America. I've traveled and worked in other parts of the planet, not as fortunate as we are. I am a longtime Alaskan, and I guess I should tell you I read well. And rumor has it that that's an important requirement in this task at hand. I certainly understand and value what it means to be a citizen and the obligation to serve, as do you. I want to be involved in the process that ensures that people are treated fairly under the laws and our Constitution. The Commission on Human Rights has great integrity, and it's an honor to serve. I would like to do that. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Questions from the committee? I'll just jump in, and we do have your general information form that you filled out, and you had originally listed that you were interested in a position on the Board of Regents, and then you also, as your second position, mentioned that you were interested in the Humanities Forum, and I'm just curious what if this is the Commission on Human Rights is something you are interested in. Is it sort of how you ended up being on this commission?
Well, I certainly understand based upon that track record. Yes, I am interested in the Board of Regents, and I am very much interested in the Humanities Forum, and have worked with them. But I should tell you that I happen to be the only family member for a long crew who's not a lawyer. I've grown up caring intensely about constitutional law, and been immersed in the rights of citizens and equity and so forth. So I'm no stranger to this. And when I was asked about the Human Rights Commission, I was thrilled. So it's not something new to me. It's something I'm pretty passionate about. And yes, I would like to do it.
Okay. And just looking through your qualifications, you. Your employment history, your educational history, your training is very impressive, and it looks like you're certainly qualified for the position. So you've been on the commission now for several months?
I'm not officially on the commission, no, because I don't have your sanction, if you will. But I have attended a meeting, and I have read through materials. I've listened as we have talked about issues at hand, and I feel very much it's something that I am very comfortable with. I've not been involved in any decision maker or anything like that. I need to actually be on a case. Of course, I need to have your authorization.
Well, in many cases, you get appointed and then you begin to serve right away on boards and commissions, and then it comes before the legislature, and we at that time give an up or down vote. But there are many boards and commissions and positions where people serve without legislative while they're waiting for legislative approval. Just curious, in the time that you've sort of followed human rights commissions, do you see any challenges that are facing Alaska in terms of reducing and preventing discrimination? And if you have any ideas on how we can improve our situation as far as discrimination goes?
Well, I have to tell you that after spending the first 2 days, my initial 2 days in Anchorage at the commission office, I came away and said to my husband, I am so impressed that folks from anywhere in Alaska can call, they can walk in that door, and they can call up on the phone, and they will be able to talk to someone right then. There's none of this pussyfooting around. That's very impressive when you consider that the workload that they have. So I suppose it's always the more communication we have about the having access to that particular set of tools is something that we can do better. There are nothing really jumps out at me in terms of actual needs, but as long as my boots have been on the ground and in many different arenas, I certainly will keep my ear to the ground in a discreet sort of a way.
Okay, thank you. Senator Geislaw has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ms. Bruce, I sat in on the Legislative Budget and Audit review of this commission during this last year, and one of their findings was that these cases were taking a very long time to resolution. Now, I am also aware that there's a tremendous amount of reading along with this position, and just wondered what your thoughts were on the length of time for the commission to reach resolution on issues and the workload.
Well, I am aware of that concern that was registered, but I also have to say that that I think the record will show that there's been a very considerable improvement in that length of time that it takes to bring something to issue. But, you know, there are things we don't think about. Like a complainant will come in, and then they can't find them. You know, and they have to talk to them personally. You know, they have to talk to them eye to eye, face to face, I think. And so there are a lot of factors that you might not be aware of that string that out. I certainly don't think it's the fault of the commission not doing their work or being inefficient. Their workload is huge, but I was surprised at those factors that make it so hard to bring something to resolution quicker than it is. I don't think it's, that's a burden that could be laid so much on the commission itself.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions from committee members? Okay, I don't see any. Ms. Bruce, thank you for your time. And what we'll do is, we're going to wait until the end, and if it's the will of the committee, we will forward all the names on at that point in time, or if anyone would like to break out the names, we can do that as well. But I think I'll wait till the end.
Would you like me to stay on the line?
You don't need to stay on the line, but thank you for your time, and thank you for your service to the state.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's next move on to Mark Fish, who has served on the commission since October of 2007. Welcome, Mark. If you could put yourself on the record and give us a brief overview of why you would like to renew your service on the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Fish. As you stated, I've served out a term on the Alaska State Commission of Human Rights already, and am interested in serving another term. One of my primary reasons for being interested in serving another term is the fact that I was actually asked to. And I do believe it's not only a privilege to serve, but a duty to serve when called. In that realm, when I reviewed my reasons why I could not find any reasons that were other than selfish. So I think I do have the, a record of my decisions, references of my fellow commissioners and staff that the governor looked at, and I think they came to the same conclusion that I would be a valuable asset to the Human Rights Commission. And with that, I'd like to not waste your time talking a lot, just answering your questions that you have, I think, is more valuable.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Fish. And in the time you've been on the commission since 2007, as we mentioned, do you think the commission is living up to its standard of its mission statement to eliminate and prevent discrimination?
Well, I think there's that's our task is a great one, and I think there's certainly challenges among the way that. That I think the staff does a real good job of filtering through, and I would I think my fellow commissioners too have a good interest. As in anything, you know, when you have a review, even a periodic review, there's obviously things that could we could do better, and one of those things I think is my fellow commissioners. We're pretty spread out on the state, and we're not always easy to get together at the same time. I think what our the commission can do, the commissioners can do, and I know the chairman is working on this now, is to hash out a better, a more efficient way of the commissioners coming to decisions. There are plenty of reasons that a case is delayed beyond our control. But there are things that we can do within our control that I think you'll see being implemented in the future.
All right. Thank you. We have a question from Senator Pasvan.
Thank you, Mr. Fish. You've completed a term, and I think it's a good opportunity to kind of generally ask your thoughts on what do you think about the goals of the Human Rights Commission itself, and then what is your participation in accomplishing those goals?
Through the chair, Senator, the goals of the commission, I think, are basically the primary essence of what government should be doing is ensuring the rights of individuals. How we can best do that is, I think, through an objective view of the standards of the rule of law that we have and a critical assessment at the end of that review on a case-by-case basis. One thing is the law is black and white, but when you're dealing with humans, you have feelings are involved too, and I think it's very important that you have citizens from that can relate to these cases, that can apply their judgments and the law justly.
Mark, do you have any, this is Bill Wilkowski, do you have any specific changes to commission policies or procedures that you think could maybe make the commission run a little bit better, more efficient?
Well, I think the staff does a real good job on their end. I think the commissioners themselves what we have to do is be more efficient once we get a case, be more efficient in dispatching that case. Sometimes it's tough. We're not always, you have three commissioners on a case and they're not always in state at the same time. Obviously, it's a volunteer, part-time duty that takes a little coordination, especially through the vast distances we have in rural Alaska. But, I think what we need to do is the commissioners themselves establish a timeline after getting a case where we can ensure that at least that they're all reviewed and ready for a decision in a timely manner. I think that can be done.
Do you have any suggestions for legislation that you think we could pass or anything we could do at the legislative level to assist the commission to better accomplish its mission?
Well, as you mentioned before, the numbers of complaints, I think you'll see a rise in the future as well. And I would suggest that, you know, the staff does really well, but there's perhaps needs additional support of extra investigators. And with the economy going the way it is, I see the caseloads are going to be growing, and you know, with the growth of caseloads and additional work, but outside as far as legislation specifically targeting, I think what we have now is workable, and I think the commissioners can actually work within the boundaries of the regulation we have and efficiently administer this this caseload.
As I mentioned before, the number of complaints increased 20%, according to statistics we have. And just curious if you what you would attribute that to, if you have any sort of attribution. Is there just more discrimination going on, or is just more people becoming aware of the laws in the commission? Do you have a sense?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that you're going to see the increases because, people, frankly, are losing economic opportunity. And sometimes it's through discrimination. Sometimes it's through, a lack of work. But when that happens, employers have to look at who they're going to let go, and they make those decisions. And if I belong to a protected class, sometimes it seems obvious that that decision was discriminatory. And I think it's incumbent on the commissioners to really look at that closely. I do think it's an economic thing. I also think that folks are being more aware of their opportunities. That's a double-edged sword. By the way, it works both ways. You got employers that are more aware of human rights law, so if someone wants to violate it, they're more savvy about it. I don't think you've seen the blatant discrimination that you have in the past, but it's more subtle. And the people who feel discriminated against, I think the ones filing the complaints are a little more savvy on their rights as well. So it presents a real challenge. And I think, like I said, with an aging workforce, I think we're going to see more age discrimination classes or cases come up. And for economic reasons, the marketplace is smaller, and you still have the same number of people looking for work. So I think that in the future, that's going to be a major drive in our challenges.
Further questions from committee members? Senator Meyer.
Mark, this is Senator Meyer, and I thank you, first of all, for serving on the commission and looking through your resume here. You have a very impressive military background, so appreciate your service to our country through the military. How many times does the commission meet?
Through the chair, Senator, we generally have quarterly meetings. On occasion, something will come up in the interim that, again, we'll meet between those. But that's pretty much it.
Okay. And if I could follow up, Mr. Chairman, do you meet, like, for a day or 2 days or 3 days? How long do you meet when you do meet?
Quarterly meetings usually are a day and a half to 2 days long, depending on the workload and decisions that we have to come by.
Okay, I realize you're not getting paid a whole lot to do this, but have you guys considered meeting more frequently to, kind of eliminate the backlog?
through the chair, Senator. The meetings generally don't consist of making those decisions. They're pretty much administrative in nature. The decisions that we make, generally how it works, is three commissioners assigned to a case. They get the paperwork to review that case, and then they announce their availability to make that decision, and that get together before or after meetings, and getting together those three commissioners to make those meetings. So we do have an opportunity to be together at meetings, and after the meetings, those commissioners that have cases to be decided will decide those cases, but many times, we decide between those meetings on those cases.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Okay, I don't see any. Mark, thank you for your service to the state, and thank you for your, as Senator Meyer said, you 20 years in the National Guard. Thank you for your service. I know. You also served as president of the community council in Airport Heights, and I know that can be those community councils can be challenging. So thank you for your public service, and we rely on volunteers to serve our state in a lot of different capacities. So thanks for putting yourself forward and doing that. Let's move on now to Joanne Holmes, and Joanne was appointed to the commission in June, and Joanne. Please put yourself on the record and give us a brief overview of your qualifications and why you're interested in serving on the commission.
Yes, good morning. My name is Joanne Holmes. I've been very excited since I was appointed. I have, in the past, I served on the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct, the Alaska Sentencing Commission. When I was very young, I served on the Model Children's Code Task Force. I learned a lot over the years about how commissions work. I originally had applied for the parole board because some of the areas of work that I've worked in, of course, has been criminal justice, and I was very interested in that. When this was offered to me, I was more than pleased to accept the appointment. There was nothing available on it when I had gone through the lists, and I've attended two actual commission meetings. There's a tremendous amount of reading involved, as far as my experience goes, both my voluntary community service and the work that I've done over the years has been in the areas of grant administration with Alaska Native nonprofit organizations. I worked for many years at the Alaska Federation of Natives. I worked for the Alaska Native Foundation. I also lived out in the bush, working as village administrator. The biggest part of my experience, of course, in working all of the jobs that I've ever worked, has been in grant writing, and that has to do with setting goals and objectives. And not only did we have to write the grants, we had to administer them, which is basically meeting the goals that we said that we were going to meet. And I think my strongest background is in that area, because I think with the legislative budget and audit information that came out, that it's the kind of thing that I have a lot of experience in doing, and I think it may be time for the commission to sit down, have a special meeting where we talk about the audit and go through the mandates of the commission and set some strategic goals continue the work. I mean, I think that, as stated before, is that the caseload is incredible. That's not going to get easier to manage, unless we have more staff. But we have other things besides the cases that we're mandated to do, and one is outreach, which has been very difficult to do because of the small staff. We have a huge state. However, I think that a real positive sit-down where we sit down and discuss strategies for our outreach. I think it's really important. I understand that we can't serve everyone. We only have so much time, and we only have so much staff. But to have, you know, set a goal that's possible, and then when, you know, if we reach the goal, fine. If we don't reach that goal for our outreach, then try to figure out, well, how do we resolve this? And because I think it's really important. We have, you know, small villages, we have regional, you know, service centers, we have the larger cities, and we have employers, you know, everything from oil companies to school districts. Reading through some of the cases that that have been decided, I found it was really disappointing to see some of these employers that I just assumed, you know, should have the ability to not discriminate. Found that they were discriminating against their employees, and I just was very disappointed. And it's the kind of thing, well, I think employers do need to know, and we have some, you know, employers who employ large numbers of people, and to target those employers to give them information. And a lot of times these cases are stemmed out of ignorance. Other than that, well, if you have any questions of me specifically, I do know that the issue of the age discrimination has become a national problem. And it's no less in Alaska, but we've got an aging baby boomer population. So, if there's any questions, I'd be willing to answer.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Questions? You mentioned, and I appreciate that you've sort of looked in and looked at some of the issues that are facing the commission. Do you believe the commission is doing enough to prevent or educate communities about discrimination?
Do I believe the commission is doing enough to prevent
or educate? Educate communities, employers, employees about discrimination.
I think that there has been some of that has been going on, but I think it's needs to be nailed down, and the commission is the only one that really can do that, so that the staff knows, okay, here are the employers that we wish to contact and work with in the next year. Here are the ones we want you to work with in the next 2 years. Because I don't think that the commission has made it clear that is one of their mandates, and it is a priority. And I think it's really important because we do need to, you know, like any other law, if it's criminal justice, I mean, part of the whole thing is to not just catch the bad guys, but to educate. That's my feeling. Yes, I think that there can be work done there in that area.
All right. Ms. Holmes, I don't see any other questions. Thank you for putting your name forward. Just looking over the documents that we have, you have a long, long, impressive history of service to the state. I see you were appointed by Governor Egan to represent the interests of Alaska Native children. I see you have served on the Alaska Commission of Judicial Conduct, the Alaska Sentencing Commission, the Governor's Model Children's Code Task Force. So thank you for your many years of service. And again, we can't operate these commissions without people putting their names forward and serving as volunteers. So thank you for that and for putting your name forward for this commission. Okay, let's move on now to our last nominee, and that's Joyce Skaffelstad. Joyce, if you could put yourself on the record, welcome to the committee. Give us a brief overview of your qualifications to serve on the commission and why you're interested in serving on the commission.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Senate Affairs Committee members. My name is Joyce Skaffelstad. I've been nominated to a public seat on the Human Rights Commission vacated by Karen Rhodes. I'm an Alaska-grown, lifelong resident of our state. I have a wide spectrum of life skills and experience that will benefit me as a member of the Human Rights Commission. My recent employment as a state magistrate and deputy training judge, I think, will benefit me if I'm confirmed to this appointment. When I was a state magistrate, there was an emphasis on detail, application of the law, and I think that this will help contribute to the difficult issues that the commission is tasked with. It was my belief as a magistrate that my primary goal was to ensure that defendants and litigants coming before the court understood their rights and responsibilities in the process of the court system. I believe that these skills are a good fit for this group and will enable me to work effectively with the current commission members and staff. I believe my life purpose is to serve others. It's what I enjoy doing, and through this venue, I have an opportunity to offer my life skills and talents to the state of Alaska as a volunteer. I've submitted a number of candidate statements and applications, so I guess I'll just open myself up for questions if anybody wants to pose things to me.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Joyce, maybe if you could talk a little bit about what you perceive as some of the challenges for the commission, and maybe any ideas that you have on how we can improve the commission.
When I first talked with Paula, Ms. Haley, the executive director, one of the things that I had questioned her about was I reviewed a number of the hearings that were made available online, the transcripts and the judgments and stuff that had come down. And one of the things that was done was referring people to training. They were ordered to train their management in the laws prohibiting discrimination against persons with disabilities, for instance. And my question to her was, who does the training? And she said there are various agencies, and I think this kind of goes along with the outreach that Ms. Holmes talked about in how do we help people not to violate the rules, because some of it is just ignorance, not intentional. And I think that the state has a wonderful website, the Boards and Commissions, Human Rights Commission, to do that, and that might be a reason why there's an increase in filings, because there are more forms available online. There's more information that you can look at hearings and see, well, you know, the average person might say, well, this person got awarded a judgment because the same type of thing that's affecting me. So there's that website is tremendous for making people aware of their rights, and we see an increase of internet usage in the villages and smartphones, and you have more access, more communication, and I think that you will see an increase of filings as people become aware of their rights, and that's a good thing. But my observation was, and I guess I've lost track of what the original question was, but I haven't had a chance to meet with any staff, a sit-down briefing or anything, and I'm just taking my information from the website, and right off the bat, I think that's a great tool and a way to get information out to people to educate. And but in educating people, then you could very easily see an increase in filings, too.
Thank you, Joyce. Other questions? Okay, I don't see any. And when there's a lack of questions, that's usually a pretty good sign from the committee that they're pretty impressed with the nominees that we have. And I would just say thank you. Just looking through your sheet that you filled out, there's really just a wealth of public service and experience here all throughout Alaska. And I thank you for putting your name forward, Joyce. Okay, with that, I want to thank all the nominees who've put their names forward and offered themselves up to volunteer for our state. And if there's no objection, I would take a motion to forward the names of all four nominees to a joint session of the legislature for consideration. Such a motion does not reflect the intent of individual members to vote for or against any particular nominee.
Chair, I so move.
Okay, is there any discussion? Is there any objection? I don't see any. The names of all four nominees will be forwarded on then, and we are adjourned.